This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. We are here every week at this time. I've got an exciting interview lined up for you today with Mr. Edward Hugh. Mr. Hugh joined us this past week from his home in Spain, and I recorded a conversation with him. Mr. Hugh is viewing firsthand what's going on in Spain. In his words, they're really experiencing a deflationary depression. We're going to talk to Mr. Hugh about, is there hope? Are the central banks around the world actually pursuing the right policy response to bail out all these world economies, or are they not? We're going to talk to him about something that he calls deflation-driven demographics. I know that sounds like a mouthful, but we'll explore that with him as well. So you want to stay tuned for those conversations. I also want to remind you that if you'd like to subscribe to the Everything Financial Radio program in podcast form, you can do that by visiting the iTunes store. All you have to do is search under Everything Financial Radio, and you could subscribe to our twice-weekly podcasts. You can also go there to listen to any of the interviews we've had with any past guest experts. Also, a quick reminder, we do have a one-day new retirement rules class coming up on November the 22nd. That will be held at the Western Michigan University campus on East Beltline in Grand Rapids. To get more information, just visit newretirementrules.com. The website is newretirementrules.com. As I said, you can get more information there, or you can register while capacity remains. The cost for the one-day class is $49. That's the cost for the book, all the handouts, and lunch for you and a guest. It's all-inclusive. You'll get the book ahead of time, so you can do some reading. There's just a couple chapters we'd like you to read before you come to the class. $49 is the cost. If you've not yet attended, we'd encourage you to check it out. Again, the website is newretirementrules.com. I am pleased to have on the Everything Financial Radio program first-time guest, Mr. Edward Hugh. Mr. Hugh is a macroeconomist who specializes in growth and productivity theory, demographic processes and their impact on macro performance, and the underlying dynamics of migration flows. Mr. Hugh is joining us today from Spain, where he lives, and his most recent book is titled, Is the Euro Crisis Really Over? Will Doing Whatever It Takes Be Enough? And you can check that out at Amazon.com. And Edward, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Dennis.
You know, one of the big topics, economically speaking, around the world, Edward, has been quantitative easing, and the United States, the UK, Japan have all engaged in QE. For our listeners maybe that aren't familiar with what exactly is QE, quantitative easing, or whatever other name you might want to call it, can you give our listeners just a very quick 101 level explanation of what that is?
Well, basically, yes, it's a technique for increasing the central bank balance sheet. I mean, essentially the central bank buys assets. These assets could be sovereign bonds, or they could be private sector loans or other instruments to increase the level of its balance sheet in an attempt to influence monetary policy and the effectiveness of monetary policy when interest rates are at a very low level and possibly even at zero.
So, Edward, the United States, the UK, and Japan have all engaged in quantitative easing or basically creating money to buy these assets. Describe the similarities and differences between the QE programs in each of these areas or each of these countries, if you would.
Well, yeah, I prefer to really split these countries into two. I mean, the United Kingdom and the United States on the one hand, and Japan and the euro area on the other. I mean, I think that the kind of QE that was practiced both in the United States and in the United Kingdom was essentially about trying to maintain financial stability or stability in the financial sector in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. And it wasn't a question of trying to raise inflation expectations. And what we've seen in Japan, because of course Japan has been having problems now for more than a decade and a half, has been quantitative easing, which is destined towards trying to raise the price level as its primary target. And this is the context in which the discussion of quantitative easing is taking place at the moment in Europe. So the objectives of the two kinds of quantitative easing are rather different, if you like. In the United States case, and I know there's a lot of debate about how effective it's been and whether it's achieved its objectives or not, but I mean, it was rather like putting cotton wool around a patient when it goes into the operating theatre to make sure there's no unfortunate accident, while the other sort of QE that we're seeing now in Japan and beginning in Europe is to do with trying to increase economic activity and generate inflationary expectations to try and ward off deflation.
So describe, if you would, Edward, what is, because the whole idea of quantitative easing in Europe is a fairly new development. Describe for the listeners what's actually happening in Europe.
Well, I mean, as everybody knows, we had an economic crisis just like the United States did in the aftermath of the Lehman Brothers collapse. But Europe's struggled considerably to come out of this crisis. I mean, when I say Europe, I think we've got to peel off the UK because it's a rather different case. But those countries that participate in the monetary experiment known as European Monetary Union or the Euro have had great difficulty coming out of the crisis, in part because the euro is a currency which is subscribed to by 18 different countries, and each of those countries are not like states in the United States. Each of those countries has its own sovereign government and its own opinions, and European policy can only really move ahead on the basis of consensus, which is what makes it very difficult to adopt proactive rather than reactive policies, if you like. Now, what's been clear, there was a first stage of the post-global financial crisis situation where various countries on the European periphery, in particular Greece in the first place, then Portugal, Ireland, Spain, and then Italy, had increasing problems actually financing their deficits. And increasing problems really in the financial markets with stability due to the fact that they've been running large fiscal deficits and large current account deficits. For people who are familiar with economic history a little bit, you know, there were some features of this that looked rather like the Asian crisis of 1998, countries with unsustainable external positions and fiscal situations that were getting out of hand. Now, Mario Draghi, who's the president of the European Central Bank, brought all this to a halt as it was increasingly getting out of control, simply by saying, and this is where I get the subtitle of my book from, that he would hold the euro together by doing whatever it takes. And really, this was a decisive moment in that initial crisis, because he suggested that the European Central Bank was had no limits to what it would do in order to maintain the euro together. And since the crisis prior to 2012 had been about an existential crisis, about whether the euro could continue or not, really that brought that phase of the crisis to a halt. But, I mean, underlying this, there are a whole set of issues, especially in the countries which we call the periphery countries, principally in southern Europe, about having got their economies into such a poor condition and bad situation, how they were going to be able to resolve this problem, given that in the past they had put things straight by devaluing the currency and exporting. Given that they were now in a euro and are continue to be in a euro, where they can't devalue themselves, how they were going to put their economy straight. And this concern or difficulty has been lingering now for the last 2 or 3 years. We've seen various attempts, you know, to come out of what you could call almost an ongoing depression on the periphery. With, for instance, in countries like Spain and Italy, Spain and Greece, you have unemployment rates of between 25% and 27%. Economies that have shrunk, as in Italy, for maybe the last 4 years consecutively. How this was going to be put straight, and now what we're seeing is gradually the other parts of the Euro group, which were previously called the core, beginning, you know, there were countries like France and Germany beginning themselves to have some signs of economic stagnation. I mean, the most recent preoccupations in Europe this very week are concerned with whether or not Germany itself is going to fall back into recession. So, you know, since previously Germany had been thought of as a strong point in the European or in the European Euro area economies, and given that Germany is now seeming to have problems that are not that different, only in degree, from some of the problems that some of the other countries are having, it raises the question, is something more happening here?
Well, we are chatting today with Mr. Edward Hugh, and Mr. Hugh is the author of Is the Euro Crisis Really Over? Will Doing Whatever It Takes Be Enough? You can get a copy of the book at Amazon.com, and we will continue our conversation with Edward when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you're with me today, and I'll continue my conversation with Mr. Edward Hugh in the next segment. You know, in the last segment, I asked Mr. Hugh to give us a definition of what exactly quantitative easing means. What does QE mean exactly? Mr. Hugh gave me an answer that was approximately like this. He said that QE is a technique for increasing the central bank balance sheet in an attempt to influence monetary policy when interest rates are at very low levels, possibly even near zero. Well, I bet there's a lot of you out there that listen to that definition of quantitative easing, and you still really don't know what that means, and you especially don't know how that might affect you. So in this segment, I want to just take some time to explain what exactly is quantitative easing. I'm going to try to simplify it as much as I can, and I want to cover it in some details so that in the future, whenever anyone mentions QE or quantitative easing, you'll know exactly what this is. Now, in order to understand quantitative easing, you have to understand that money evolves over time, and if you didn't listen to the last couple weeks' programs, you can go to the iTunes store and search under Everything Financial Radio, and you can pull up podcasts of those programs, because on those programs, I talk about something called the money cycle, and I won't have time to cover it in detail again in today's segment, but basically the first couple steps in the money cycle, which the money cycle can take anywhere from 80 to maybe even 100 or 110 years to evolve, money is something tangible. Money is a tangible asset, or it's paper money redeemed for a tangible asset at a fixed rate. For 99 years in U.S. history, from 1834 to 1933, gold sold for $20.67 an ounce. The price of gold did not vary. Money was fixed to a tangible asset. Eventually, usually due to mismanagement fiscally by politicians, we find that the money cycle goes to the third step, and we have a fiat currency. Money is now money by decree. And at this point, often a central bank is set up, and it's happened a couple other times in U.S. history, where a central bank, which is an institution designated by the government to control the money supply, they decide what the money supply is going to be. So the Federal Reserve is the central bank today, and the central bank is actually controlled by private bankers. So the U.S. government back in 1913 decided to pass a law that would really delegate monetary policy to a group of private bankers. So they control the money supply. Well, the money supply really consists of two components. Now, I'm oversimplifying this for the explanation today, but the money supply has cash and it has credit. Now, cash would be currency, which would be physical money like the green stuff you have in your wallet or purse and coins, and that's not much when it comes to the total money supply. And it's also bank cash. These are bank reserves. And this is cash that a commercial bank has to keep as a cushion against excessive customer withdrawals. So cash is the money in your wallet and the reserves the bank has to keep. Credit consists of bank loans. The business of banking is really attracting a customer deposit and then lending some of that new deposit to consumers and businesses. Every time a bank accepts a deposit, it has to add a certain fraction of it called a reserve ratio to its cash reserves. Now, the reserve ratio is controlled by the Fed and is currently set at a very low rate of 10%. Now, at one time, the reserve requirement was 20%. And if you go to the Federal Reserve's website, they explain this money multiplier, I should say, in detail. If you put $1,000 in your bank, that $1,000 can expand up to $10,000 if it moves around. Well, how does money move around in the fractional reserve banking system? People have to borrow money and banks have to loan money. That's how money moves. If I go put $1,000 in my bank, my banker has to keep $100 or 10% of that in reserve and can loan out the other $900. That $900 loan can be used to purchase some consumer good, maybe a computer, and the seller of that computer would take the $900, put it in her bank, and that banker would have to reserve $90 and loan out the other $810. You get the idea. If money's moving at full speed or full velocity, that $1,000 deposit can expand to $10,000. On the other hand, if the reserve requirement is 20%, the $1,000 deposit can only expand to $5,000. Banks have to keep more of the reserve. Well, here's what bankers and economists in particular, are really, really afraid of, and that is deflation. Deflation is defined as a shrinking or contraction of the money supply. Deflation is what happened in the 1930s, and it's not very much fun. The symptoms are downright ugly. So what did the Fed do? Well, the first thing the Fed did after the financial crisis was lower interest rates. Make loans cheaper and increase demand for them. Well, they reduced short-term interest rates to zero. They've been there for 6 years, and we all know now that hasn't really worked. Why? Money was not moving. Money has to move through loans, and banks still didn't want to loan, and consumers still didn't want to lend. And as we've talked about on the program, consumer debt levels were at such high levels, it didn't really matter what the interest rates were. Consumers couldn't afford another payment, and not much has changed. So money supply kept shrinking, and that's when the Fed pulled out the big gun. They decided to print money and add cash to bank reserves. That, in essence, is what quantitative easing is. Banks print money, and they go buy an asset that a bank has on their balance sheet. So the Federal Reserve prints money, and they go to the bank and say, hey, you've got these U.S. Treasury bonds and these mortgages. We're going to give you cash and buy these, and that's what Mr. Hugh meant when he said it's a technique for the central bank to expand its balance sheet. Essentially, they're printing money out of thin air, buying assets that were tied to something tangible with an asset that was just newly created. So if a bank sells a mortgage-backed security to the Fed and takes some newly printed money and adds it to their reserves, what's happening is we've got a newly created asset, an asset literally created out of thin air, being traded for something that has a tangible asset backing it. A mortgage-backed security has a piece of real estate backing it. How long, and this is the big question, how long can newly created assets via quantitative easing, these newly created assets that don't have tangible backing, be exchanged for assets that are backed by something tangible? I don't know the answer to that, but the great economist Herbert Stein said, if something cannot go on forever, it will stop, and that's certainly the case. We talk about this in our class, New Retirement Rules. If you've not yet attended, you can go to get some information at newretirementrules.com. We've got a class coming up November 22, a one-day class at Western Michigan University. Again, the website to get more information or to register, newretirementrules.com. I'd encourage you to check it out. I'll be back with Edward Hugh in a moment.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio Program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I'm chatting today with the author of the book, Is the Euro Crisis Really Over? Will Doing Whatever It Takes Be Enough? Mr. Edward Hugh. And it's a pleasure to have you on the program today, Edward. Thanks for being here.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Let's go back and talk about Europe, because you had mentioned in the last segment that there's the periphery countries that have really been in a deflationary depression, and now some of the core countries are starting to experience economic difficulties as well. Do you see a massive QE program in Europe's future, given that you've got really a monetary union but not a political union? Do you see all 18 countries getting on the same page?
Well, I think at the end of the day, they'll have no choice but to do this. But I think it's going to take longer than people in financial markets are imagining. I mean, if we look at what's been happening to bond yields across the euro area during the last six months, we've seen them fall very, very sharply, regardless almost of which country we're talking about. This process has happened because people imagine that eventually the European Central Bank will have to do something like what they've been doing in Japan, which is called Abenomics. And indeed, people are even talking here in Europe now about Draghinomics as a European version of this. But, of course, this ignores the institutional difficulty, as you're pointing out, Dennis, of putting this together. I mean, we've got a Germany on the one hand, which is very, very reluctant to take on board responsibility for debt from the southern European countries. I mean, whether we're talking about private debt, which could come from the Spanish banks through programs to buy asset-backed securities, packaging private sector loans, or whether we're talking about sovereign bonds from a country like Italy, where, of course, the debt-to-GDP ratio is already over 130% and rising, and where the possibility, or even probability, you could say, of having some kind of debt restructuring somewhere in the future can't at all be ruled out. So the Germans are very, very nervous about this. Another factor that we've noticed here in Europe, and in Europe generally, including the United Kingdom, that is, over the last couple of years, is this crisis is having political consequences, because movements which are, if you like, dissatisfied not only with the way the crisis has been handled, but with the current status quo, are growing across virtually all of the countries. You've got in the United Kingdom a party which is called UKIP, which is basically a United Kingdom independence party that wants a referendum to leave the European Union. You've got in Germany a new party which is called AFP, which is basically Eurosceptic and got around 10% of the vote in the most recent regional elections in Saxony, and this is coming from virtually nowhere. In countries like Italy and Greece and Spain, you've got anti-establishment parties that are now getting around 20% of the vote that are very, very hostile to things like the Troika, which was the group formed by the IMF, the ECB, and the European Commission that operated the bailouts here. And here in Spain, for example, you've got a movement that wants a vote for the independence of Catalonia from Spain. So political tensions in Europe, and in particular in the euro area, are growing. And this makes it much more difficult for Mario Draghi at the central bank to implement the kind of policies that people are expecting. Having said that, given that I think that Europe is sinking into a kind of demographically driven deflation of the type that we've seen in Japan, eventually, you know, they're not going to have any other alternative but to go for it.
You know, you used a phrase there, Edward, demographically driven deflation. And it's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because certainly you look at Japan, you look at the U.S., you look at the U.K., Europe, arguably, private sector debt levels are at or near all-time highs, and yet you have this aging population. So my question for you is, I guess maybe a two-part question. First, define what you mean by demographically driven deflation, and then to what extent are these economic woes attributable to excessive debt levels, and to what extent are they attributable to demographics?
Well, it, with your permission, I'll go the other way around. I mean, I'll answer the second question first. I mean, that I think that it's a combination of the two. I mean, it's obviously the case, especially on the southern European periphery, that the high levels of household indebtedness, and in addition of government debt, put a brake on economic activity. They're a drag on economic activity. There's a deleveraging process going on, which means that the banks are reducing their balance sheets and credit is actually contracting rather than expanding, which is never very positive for economic activity. But that's a kind of normal process, which is undoubtedly happening. But I think the thing that many people haven't gotten hold of about this situation here in Europe at the moment is that there's a new dimension, which is coming from the fact that the working age populations in these countries are beginning to peak and are beginning to decline. In fact, the 2011-2012 more or less was the high point of a working age population in the euro area. What's happening at the moment is, because some countries like Spain and Greece have extraordinarily high levels of unemployment, whereas in Germany unemployment is relatively low, only about 5 or 6%. You've got movement of population and migration is taking place within the euro area as a whole from one area to another. But the overall picture, it's a zero-sum game. The overall picture is that the working age population is beginning to fall. Now, what does this mean? Well, this means, for example, that domestic demand, as well as being limited by the fact that people are in debt and can't get into more debt realistically because they can't afford it, and the banks are not willing to lend to them. In any event, given their debt levels. On top of that, there's a shift within the society away from borrowing and towards saving and getting ready for retirement. This is one of the factors that we notice as populations age. So what does this mean? It means that domestic demand gets weaker and that these countries become more dependent than ever on exports. But this weakness in domestic demand has an impact at corporate level. And again, this is another phenomenon that we're observing, because with demand stagnating or even contracting, it's not so interesting for corporates to invest in new capacity because the market isn't going to be there to justify it. There's a lot of interest in investing in the export sector, because there is demand growing outside the euro area, but inside the euro itself, and this phenomenon has been observable in Germany, I would argue, for some time now, and is part of the current slowdown that we're seeing in Germany. And, of course, it's very, very typical of what we've been seeing in Japan.
So, Edward, when you look at demographics and the fact that the working age population is shrinking, means consumer demand is shrinking, at what point does this trend reverse? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel for, say, Europe, the United States, Japan? What's the outlook?
Well, there isn't a light at the end of the tunnel in the sense that you're thinking of it, I think. I mean, I think this is a process that is going to continue. I mean, the alternative to this is really to try to keep pumping up population levels forever and ever. I mean, at the end of the day, that also is a bit absurd. The thing that really governs our living standards isn't what's happening to headline GDP growth, but is the rate of technological change. Unfortunately, the rate of technological change shows no signs of slowing down, even though I gather in the United States around the secular stagnation argument, there are people who are arguing that, in fact, even technology isn't improving as it has been before. I mean, I'm not very inclined to accept that. So I think the solution to all of this, Dennis, if there is a solution in classic terms, is to begin to accept what's happening and learn to work around it and find ways of learning to live with our reality. I mean, it's not so disastrous at the end of the day if you think about the fact that we're all living longer and are going to live longer. I mean, we just need to be aware that things aren't going to be the way they were before.
So, Edward, in the time we have left, talk a bit, if you could, about why all this should be important to American listeners who are listening to this conversation today.
Well, in the first thing I would say is because it's the future. I mean, what started happening in Japan in the 1990s, and it's really quite interesting to see the correlation, that the Japan hit deflation really in 1997, and that's exactly the year the working age population started to fall in Japan. The euro area has hit deflation more or less in 2012, 2013, at exactly the same moment in the demographic trajectory. And while at the moment the United States has had a better birth rate for a long time now than we've had here in Europe, and therefore the demographic dynamics are if you could put it like this, more positive in the sense that the U.S. population is still growing and that the pyramid isn't inverting as rapidly as it is in Europe. 10 years from now, the United States could start to look demographically much more like the euro area. I mean, the saving grace for the United States, of course, although not everybody who lives in the U.S. will agree with this, but I mean, the saving grace for the United States is that it's a country that is open historically to immigration. I mean, it's at the other extreme, if you would like, from Japan, where the situation is so difficult as we are seeing, because it's a country that's completely closed to immigration. But immigration, at the end of the day, won't solve all our problems, and I'm not even sure that it's necessary to solve them in inverted commas in that sense. What we need to do is find ways to evolve with the way the world is changing. But so that's the first reason. The second reason, very quickly, is that the United States, no man is an island. The United States lives in a world where there are other economies which are important. I mean, if one day China, for example, where they've had this one-child per family policy for more than 30 years now, follows along the path of Japan and Europe and finds itself caught in the crosshairs of deflation, then, of course, the Chinese are going to try and reduce the value of their currency in the same way as Japan and the euro area are doing. And you know, this is going to complicate life for people in the United States. I think that's quite evident. So I do think there are reasons to follow what happens in general terms in the global economy, because one day or another, they'll come to a shop somewhere around the corner from a place just near you.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Edward Hugh, the author of Is the Euro Crisis Really Over? Will Doing Whatever It Takes Be Enough? It's available on Amazon. I would encourage you to check it out. Edward, thanks for joining us today.
It's been great to be with you.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen, and thanks again to Mr. Edward Hugh for joining us this week on the program from his home in Spain. You know, in the last segment, there's a couple things that I discussed with Mr. Hugh. He talked about high private sector debt levels, which resulted in deleveraging. And he talked about something that he called demographically driven deflation. Now, in this segment, in the next 7.5 minutes or so, I want to look at both of those in as much detail as time will permit. Private sector debt levels resulting in deleveraging and demographically driven deflation. Let's start with high private sector debt levels resulting in deleveraging. What on earth does that mean? Well, just let's talk about the term deleveraging. It's a term used by economists. It's kind of a $12 word that really means get rid of debt. Deleveraging means nothing more than getting debt purged from the system. Now, forget about federal government debt for a moment, and we focused a lot of the conversation with Mr. Hugh on what's going on in Europe, but let's look just at the United States for a minute. Forgetting about federal government debt, which we really shouldn't do because it's now about $200,000 per full-time private sector worker, which is unbelievably high. But let's focus only on U.S. private sector debt. Now, private sector debt has been declining a bit since the financial crisis. Private sector debt, rather, was 95% of GDP at the financial crisis. It has now declined to about 80% of GDP. Now, GDP is gross domestic product, which is the most commonly used measure of economic output. Now, business debt, which is also private sector debt, has remained at about 80% of GDP since the financial crisis to the present. So, we've gone from about 175% to 160% of GDP when you look at household debt and business debt. And this is according to the International Business Times in an article published January 21 of 2014. Well, let's look at that in terms of real numbers. Household debt is about $13.1 trillion. Non-financial business debt is about $13.4 trillion. So when you look at household debt and business debt and add them together, you have $26.5 trillion of debt, which really dwarfs is a bad word, but it's a lot larger debt level than government debt, and the official government debt's about $17.5 trillion. So let's just say that private sector debt's a bigger number than federal debt, and it's not good news for the economy, because if federal government debt amounts to about $200,000 per full-time private sector worker, then $26.5 trillion of debt is pushing $300,000. That's not good for the economy, and debt levels will continue to be a drag on economic growth moving ahead. Now, that's obviously an opinion, but if you look at the numbers, it just can't be any other way. There's enough federal government debt that most Americans believe, who actually have taken time to understand the size of the problem, which might be admittedly a minority, but those that understand the problem know that this is really an unsolvable problem. That's not a political statement. That's a math statement. $200,000 per private sector worker is an unpayable debt. Now, when debt levels build like they did during the 80s and 90s, it can create the illusion of economic prosperity, but when debt levels contract, there's an economic price to be paid. Now, here's a really important point to remember. All economic stimulus, including quantitative easing, is designed to get banks lending again, and consumers borrowing again. But the trouble is, consumers won't borrow if there's just not enough room on the credit card, to use that metaphor. I mean, it really doesn't matter what the interest rate is or how much cash is available. If you can't afford to make another payment, you're not going to get really excited about borrowing money. Might explain why, as we talked about a couple weeks here ago on the program, that GM's had a great year selling cars, and yet the majority of the loans that they've made on new automobiles have been to subprime lenders, subprime borrowers, I should say. Now, then there's the second item I talked about with Mr. Hugh, and that's demographically driven deflation. He said as populations age, there's a shift from borrowing towards saving. Well, that's absolutely true. If you're 35 years old and one of the kids needs braces, if you don't have the money in the bank, you're going to go borrow money to make sure the kid gets braces. If you have to have a car to drive to get back and forth to work, if you haven't been able to save money to buy a car, you're going to go borrow money to buy a car. And yet, as you age and the kids move out of the house, you become empty nesters, you really shift from borrowing to paying down debt and saving to get ready for retirement. In fact, if you look at the average adult life cycle, there's education, you then enter the workforce, you then probably live in an apartment, then you get married, then you have children, then you have a home purchase, then maybe you have a second home purchase or a trade-up home purchase. The children leave, you pay down debts, you save for retirement, you might buy a vacation property or a retirement property. Now, that's not the case for every American, but certainly if you average how people spend money and what they do during their lifetime, that pretty much summarizes it. And the peak spending years are age 46 to 50. Now, here's what Mr. Hugh meant when he talked about demographically driven deflation. When you look at the U.S. economy, about 70%, almost 71% of the economy is made up of personal consumption, people going out and spending money. If you take a look at McDonald's restaurants has just reported a story out in USA Today in September. Same store sales are down 3.7%. Is it because McDonald's food has changed? Is it because they haven't done what they should do? I don't think so. I think it's purely demographics. More and more people are not eating fast food for lunch because the workforce participation rate is at a level not seen since 1971. And as people age, they typically don't eat fast food for lunch. Now, here is the crux of the problem that Mr. Hugh talked about. If you look at the baby boom, in 1929, there was about 2.5 million babies born. By 1960, there was almost 5 million. And if you lag the 1960 peak in birth rate by 46 to 50 years, you see the peak spending cycle was reached in 2006, almost perfectly at the onset of the financial crisis. We saw the same thing in Japan, whose births peaked in 1948, which means that lagging this, they actually saw their spending cycle peak in about 1994, shortly after the Nikkei, the Japanese stock market index, peaked. So there's a lot of information out there that you should be aware of. If you'd like to get more information about our new retirement rules class, where we talk about this in detail and give you a copy of the book, New Retirement Rules, go ahead and just visit the website, newretirementrules.com. You can register there or get more information. Again, the website, newretirementrules.com. That's our program for this week. Hope you enjoyed it. Tune in again next week. Bye.